The Pat Kenny Show
with Mater Private Network
on News Talk.
Russia will be forced to take retaliatory steps, both of a military, technical and other nature, in order to neutralise the threats to its national security that arise from this. Threats from the Kremlin in response to Finland's push for NATO membership. So what is Putin likely to do if that membership bid goes ahead and it is likely to be successful? Well, I'm joined by the defence editor at The Economist, Shashank Joshi. Good morning, Shashank.
Good morning.
First of all, the Finns have been anxious not to antagonise their larger neighbour, and so they haven't applied to join NATO.
Well, not yet, but it's pretty much a dead certainty that they will. We've seen in Finland a confirmation from the president, who is very widely respected, and the prime minister, that they urge an application without delay, and it's inconceivable the Swedes won't follow, because that would leave them as the only country in Northern Europe to be a member of the European Union, but not to be a member of the NATO alliance. And that's simply, you know, inconceivable for the Swedes. Just as the other way around, in the 90s, it was the Swedes who led on a bid for the European Union, and the Finns followed them, in fact, rushing to try and catch up with them in that time, in 1995, I think it was. This time round, it's the Finns in the lead. Surprisingly, we all thought it would be the Swedes in the lead, but it's the Finns. And really, the Swedes are going to follow. It's just that their political timeline is slightly different. Their ruling party has a history of being slightly more NATO sceptic, the Social Democrats, and so it'll take a bit more time, but it will come. It will come.
Now, they haven't been antagonizing the Russians, but they've every reason to despise them, because in their war with Russia in 1939-1940, they lost a huge city, their second city, to Russia. And, you know, there would be no love lost, really.
No. It's not just the Winter War, as you describe it, in which the Soviets lost over 200,000 men. It was a catastrophe, even though they did eventually, as you say, seize Finnish territory, including Karelia, this big forested region all the way north of St. Petersburg, but also a number of other wars. They fought a war after that called the Continuation War, when the Finns were on the side of the Nazis. But they all fought many, many other wars through history, I think, you know, dozens and dozens of them. And Russia has, you know, repeatedly either ruled over Finland at times or has invaded and attacked it. So there's absolutely no love lost. There's a real sense of bitterness. The Finns are very cautious about expressing that bitterness, of course. They don't, you know, geopolitically, what we called Finlandization during the Cold War meant that they didn't criticize the Soviet Union publicly. And in fact, domestic politicians who did so were sort of, you know, pushed to the side. But now what we're seeing with Ukraine has completely shifted attitudes in Finland, you know, totally historic, a historic shift in public attitudes towards NATO. And I think they've decided it's just too dangerous to be on the outside.
Now, they have an 810 or 1300 kilometer border, 810 miles, with Russia. Russia's threatened to boost its troop presence along that border. But Putin is already pretty stretched in Ukraine.
Yes, I mean, you would expect Russia to think that, well, look, if they're joining NATO, we have to prepare ourselves along that border between, think about all the way from Murmansk, if you can sort of picture the Arctic geography in your head, I know it's not easy, all the way down to St. Petersburg. That stretch of the border hasn't been very heavily militarized by Russia, precisely because it has had sort of what you might call stable relations with Finland. You know, mistrustful, no love lost, but stable and predictable. That will change. In the short term, you're completely correct to note that the Russian army is entirely preoccupied. In fact, it's had to remove forces or run them down from garrisons like Kaliningrad in the Baltic, from South Ossetia and Abkhazia in Georgia, from other places, and put them into Ukraine. So there's no spare capacity. But I think if we're looking over the longer term, the next 10 years, say, it is inevitable that we're going to see Russia build up its military presence along that Finnish border, and indeed also presumably include Finland among the list of potential nuclear targets, because Finland will operate the F-35 aircraft, a very advanced stealth plane that is dual capable. And although Finland won't carry nuclear weapons, other countries in NATO that have F-35s will. And so the Russians will say, well, how are we supposed to tell the difference? We're going to have to treat you, you know, as a nuclear capable power as we would anyone else.
The Finns, as you say, they've had a stable relationship with Russia, anxious not to publicly express their bitterness and animosity towards them. But at the same time, they have prepared for war. Grain stockpiles, fuel stockpiles, a labyrinth of tunnels under the capital, Helsinki, Everyone of sort of any kind of physical fitness trained to be a reservist?
This is the one of the most militarily prepared countries in Europe. It has the biggest artillery force in Europe. It takes defense profoundly seriously. Unlike many other countries, when the Cold War ended, it didn't say, hooray, we've won. Let's disband our army or run it down and enjoy a peace dividend. They kept it up. They spend a substantial proportion of their GDP on defense. They're buying more and more advanced equipment, like I mentioned, the F-35, but also long-range missiles that can be fired from it. This is a country that prepares. Everything is oriented around defense. I was in Helsinki a week before the Russian invasion, and you realize all their car parks are sort of effectively, nuclear bunkers that were built in the Cold War, and they were designed precisely for that reason. So this is a country that has never forgotten the fact that war is a possibility. You can lose your national existence from invasion, something that most new countries in Europe haven't thought very hard about. And I think that makes them an asset to NATO, not a sort of parasite. They're not going to require NATO to sort of step in straight away. They can hold the line for a while. Now, they're a small country. They can't do it indefinitely, but ultimately they are an asset. And also, the thing I'd mention is Finnish and Swedish membership in NATO makes it easier to defend the Baltic states across the Baltic Sea. So Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, that is another big asset to NATO.
So why did Putin not anticipate this response to his invasion of Ukraine?
Well, that's very difficult to say. Did he anticipate the fact that it would be so difficult to invade Ukraine in the first place? Did he anticipate the full breadth and extent of sanctions from across the world and the fact that his economy would be on its knees? Did he anticipate the fact that there would be massive brain drain from Russia? I think he miscalculated massively, either because he thought that this would be such a simple and quick operation that the world would accept a bloodless fait accompli in Kiev. It wouldn't be a major slog in this way. Or, of course, he did anticipate it and thought, Ukraine is ultimately so important to me. I'm so worried about the prospect of NATO becoming an anti-Russia springboard for the West that I'm willing to accept all these other costs. We can't know for sure, but I think, to be honest, as I said, when I was in Helsinki a week before the war, when we knew it was coming, even the Finnish officials weren't sort of able to admit to themselves this would push them to NATO inevitably, even though it was sort of obvious to many people watching. So perhaps a sense of cognitive dissonance. They can't possibly do it. They've been, militarily non-aligned for sort of 80 years. This just isn't going to happen.
Mutterings of Russia using tactical nuclear weapons in Ukraine. What's your feeling?
Probably not. Tactical nuclear weapons are small nuclear weapons, partly because there'll be very little battlefield use to it. If you want to bomb the crap out of things, you can sort of start by, doing more conventional bombing. But also it's a political instrument to signal resolve, to force Ukraine or the West back down. It seems to me a big gamble. It seems to me that by detonating a nuclear bomb and crossing that Rubicon for the first time since 1945, you are as likely to invite some kind of Western intervention as you are to deter it. And of course, that is what Putin is trying to avoid. The purpose of his nuclear weapons is not so much coercion, to coerce Ukraine into capitulating. It is deterrence, to stop the West from intervening. And if I'm correct in that assessment, then nuclear weapons are going to remain a sort of tool in hand to say, don't intervene directly. Don't try and run the blockade on Odessa. Don't try and break the blockade on Mariupol. Don't try and enter your forces on Ukraine's side, because I will use nuclear weapons in that context. More of a deterrent tool than a coercive one.
And finally, Shashank, the trial of a Russian soldier in Kiev. He'll be in the district court accused of the murder, a war crime, of an individual who was just on the phone, took out an AK-47, shot him dead. And the Ukrainians are not going to stick around and wait for an international tribunal to do this kind of thing. But are we likely to see similar then in Moscow of some of the prisoners taken by the Russians?
Well, you can be sure we will. And they'll claim that they're being prosecuted for Nazi activities, for genocide against the Russian speakers in Ukraine, for war crimes. And look, this is a brutal war. And I'm sure there have been incidents where Ukrainians have also breached the laws of war. I've certainly seen some alleged videos of prisoners of war being shot and other things like that. So Russia will find some either real or utterly confected case to conduct a show trial like that. I think we've by now should expect that of the Russians. But the fact remains that the scale of atrocities we have seen from Russia in Ukraine, a lot of armies have commit war crimes. It happens. The Americans have done it. The Brits have done it. Obviously, you know, this occurs. But in terms of in the last 15, 20 years, on a systematic scale, this what we've seen in Russia is I think, really incomparable, the level of extrajudicial killing of civilians, of soldiers, of torture, of abuse, of sort of targeted kidnapping. These sorts of things, I'm afraid, I really haven't seen a precedent for that in the last 20, 25 years.
Shashank Joshi, defense editor at The Economist, thank you very much for joining us. Now, listening to that conversation is an Irish journalist working in Sweden, Philip O'Connor. Philip, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
It's so depressing talking about this war, but it's important, I suppose, that we should keep abreast of everything that's happening. And Shashank was saying that as sure as night follows day, that Sweden will follow the Finns into NATO.
Yeah, I think everything changed on Thursday, the 24th of February, Pat, when Russia invaded Ukraine. And, you know, I've been here for over 20 years, and the Social Democratic Party here, who are currently in a minority government, they have always been against NATO. They've always talked about the value of having the freedom to form alliances as and when necessary. And that all changed on that day, and the rumbling started. When people saw what was happening in Ukraine, they started to think, okay, maybe we can't do that anymore. Maybe we have to abandon that position. And exactly the same as Finland, that has sort of grown over the weeks and months since, and they're expected now to make an announcement as soon as this Sunday, pretty much as Finland have done, and say, okay, we're going to join NATO, we're going to start the process. And indeed, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson was here on Tuesday, I think it was, promising the Swedes that if they do decide to join NATO, that he'll put British naval forces into the Baltic Sea to protect Sweden during that process.
Now, one of the vulnerable places in Sweden was Gotland Island in the Baltic. You've been there.
Yeah, I was there last week, Pat, and it's an interesting place because it's the canary in the coal mine in the Baltic Sea. A former military commander there, the man who used to run the Home Guard there, now a man named Rutger Bartholz, he described it to me as like an aircraft carrier there. And he says whoever controls Gotland controls the Baltic Sea. So to put that in perspective, Shashank there mentioned Kaliningrad, which is where the Baltic Fleet, the Russian Baltic Fleet, is usually based. And they would be only hours away. They'd only be a couple of hundred kilometres away from Gotland. And Swedes used to have this sort of gallows humour about, imagine if we woke up one morning and the Russian had invaded Gotland. And for many years, Pat, during the Cold War, not dissimilar to Finland, that would have been the big fear. But of course, when the Berlin Wall came down, the Swedes went, okay, that's okay, the threat isn't as big as anymore. And they gradually started to demilitarise the island to the point where, at the beginning of this century, there was very little left at all. Now, military men like Rutger really objected to that. They thought, okay, the threat isn't gone completely. And now, last week, I was talking to Colonel Magnus Frikvall, who's the leader of the Gotland Regiment. He's the commander of the Gotland Regiment. And they're now in what he told me was an expansive phase. So they're desperately trying to recruit officers and soldiers to go there, to be on Gotland and to man these defences that haven't been used for almost two decades. And I was there actually with a woman who normally works at a supermarket deli counter, and she was learning to fire a pistol there. She joined the Home Guard because the people there, they don't feel an imminent threat, Pat, but they feel that they have to be ready if and when the day would come.
Okay, and Boris Johnson's that joint security arrangement he's made with Finland and with Sweden, how soon will those British naval ships be in the neighbourhood of Gotland? I mean, is it something they're deploying straight away? Do we know?
Well, as I understand it, that would start as soon as the formal process of the application to join NATO would start. But, you know, again, these things are, if they were to feel that there was a threat from Russia, I'd imagine it could happen sooner. But again, as Shashank was saying, you know, Mr. Putin is very busy elsewhere. He's having to commit a lot of forces to Ukraine that maybe he hadn't originally planned for. So again, the people on Gotland were saying that they don't feel that the threat is imminent. They don't feel like they could wake up tomorrow or Saturday or Sunday and that, the Russians would be there. So, you know, that's not the case for them. But, you know, if rumblings were to be made, I think you would see, as you know, aspirant NATO nations, I think you would see the British coming to their aid very, very quickly indeed to show that there'll be no pushover in this situation.
Now, Shashank pointed out the military preparedness of Finland. They spend a considerable amount of their budget on defence because they're only too aware of what the Russians can do to them. How prepared is Sweden? How much of their budget do they devote to defence?
I don't think they would be as well prepared as the Finns, Pat. And again, you know, the fact that Finland has this long 800-mile land border with Russia means that their focus is very much on that threat and has been, you know, since before the Second World War, really. Sweden doesn't have that. It has always been a naval threat or a threat from the air. And over the years, you know, since the end of the Cold War, Sweden has successively reduced the amount that it spends on its military forces. Now, one of the big things that disappeared here was that there used to be compulsory military service here. That's completely gone. And that was a huge expense of the state. And now it's voluntary. And even those, you know, volunteers they do get, not all of them make it into the military. And that's now being seen by many people within the military, like Rutger Barholz, as a bit of an own goal. Because what you have now is you have generations of people. You know, my father-in-law is Swedish. He would have been in the military for a year and a half. My brother-in-law, he would have done the same thing. But, you know, subsequent generations don't have even that basic military training that they would have gotten. And you always had to go back, you know, for a day, a year, you know, just to brush up on the new weapons and the tactics and the things that were out there. That doesn't happen for maybe the last generation or so. So Sweden is kind of missing in that. They are a great technological power. So, you know, companies like Saab here, they will be known for maybe making cars and engines in Ireland, but they're also very much involved in the making of military aircraft and systems and tools for that. There's any amount of technology companies engaged in those things. So those technological capacities are still there, but the actual manpower, the ability to put men and women on the ground in a defensive capacity, that has really fallen off over the last decades, especially compared to Finland.
And I presume that debate now is very lively in Sweden. What about general support for accession to NATO? I mean, given there was such a strong debate about it and a majority in, not in favour of going, has the public mood really shifted dramatically?
Yeah, I would say it's an incredible swing. Of course, you know, as we well know, Pat, Sweden's a consensus society. It takes a long time to make decisions here. But one of the important things is that as many people have to be on board as possible. And in this case, it happened very, very quickly. I don't think it's, you know, I think many Swedes would have looked at the news coming out of places like Mariupol, the reporting coming out of, you know, massacres in places like Bucha, and they look at that and they go, hang on a second, this situation is not tenable anymore. I think they're very proud of their neutral record. They haven't been involved in a war for hundreds of years. The 1800s was the last time they were involved in a war. But I think they feel that the time has come now that, you know, you can't do that. You literally have to pick a side in this situation. Of course, they would prefer to remain neutral, but that's just not possible anymore.
All right, Philip, look, thank you very much for that very informative look at Sweden's attitude to NATO and its defence. And after Sunday, perhaps we'll be talking to you again about the decision to go forward. But thank you very much for joining us from Sweden. That's Philip O'Connor, an Irish journalist based there.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Matter Private Network.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.